millions of people who want to write books, but so few of them actually take action because they don't perceive themselves to be an author. So I feel one is that coming in their own way, but the way to get over that is simply start with the first few steps or work with somebody. Work with somebody you resonate with, whether it's a coach, it's a friend. Just go and say, somebody you trust, you feel comfortable and safe with, and simply say, you know what, I have the desire, I want to make quilts. And will you hold me accountable? I'm going to try to do this, you know. So would you mind if I check in with you or speak to somebody you know who's done it? So I would say that one is either find a coach or a mentor or find somebody who you trust, who you feel that would be this non-judging person will support you in your journey, but take the first few steps. I think that's the key.
This is the Cracking Creativity Podcast, episode number 55 with Puneet Sachdev. Welcome to the Cracking Creativity Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Chung, and I'm here to show you how creatives turn their ideas into action, create interesting projects, and build an engaged audience through shared passions. Now let's get creative. In this episode of the Cracking Creativity Podcast, I talked to Puneet Sachdev. Puneet worked for years in the hotel industry and with General Electric as a management consultant. He now uses that knowledge in his work as a consultant, creative philanthropist, and coach. He is also the author of Deepa Wishes Daddy Happy Birthday, a book based on the time he spent with his daughter. He uses 100% of the proceeds from the book to support the education of underprivileged children. The book also began his work as a creative philanthropist. In this episode, learn how Puneet turned his idea into reality, why you need to put yourself out there, and the importance of being present. Now on to the episode. Welcome to another episode of Cracking Creativity. Today I have on Puneet Sachdev, and he is a creative philanthropist, a coach, and the author of Deepa Wishes Daddy Happy Birthday.
Thanks, Kevin.
Puneet, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and some of what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. I can definitely do that. So I started off life in India, New Delhi, and spent about 30 odd years over there, after which I moved to the UK for a while before getting to the US a couple of years ago. And how creative philanthropy came about for me was that when I moved from Scotland in Edinburgh, I moved to San Francisco. My daughter and kid, they went to Australia, and I was coming out over here, and I was really missing my daughter. And her birthday was coming up. This is September, and her birthday was in the following January. That was 2014. Was wondering, what can I do for her, which will be unique, that something which only I could do. That's when I thought that maybe what I will do is that I will write. Make a book out of the story that I would tell Ela, that's my daughter's name, when it was my turn to put her to bed. So I would make up the story about this two-year-old girl who lives close to a nature reserve and all her escapades. And that's what I started doing. I started writing the story on my flights back from Chicago to San Francisco, because I was management consulting then. My client was based in Chicago and I was living in San Fran. So it was usually on the 3:45 p.m. United flight out of Chicago to San Francisco that I would do my writing. And the reason I would choose the end of the week when I'm completely tired was that then at least I would not analyze what I was writing. So that's how it started off. There was no intention of having it published to a publishing house, etc. The intention was very simple, that I'm going to write this. I will illustrate it. Since I was going to Chicago, I managed to do a program at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago on illustrations. And I wrote the book, I illustrated it, and I had a shutterfly version of the book ready for Ela's birthday. Along the journey somewhere, I realized that she's a lucky gal, you know, she's going to have a lot going on for her in her life. But there are so many children out there who would not have even, a fraction of what Ela's going to have. And I wanted to use the same love, the same passion with which I put this book together to be able to help the other kids. And that's when it occurred to me, yes, well, let's see if I can have this published. And what I will do is I will commit 100% profits from the sales of my book towards supporting the education of underprivileged kids. And that's how it started off. You know, the vision kept expanding with time. I was clear that I did not really want to give money away simply without being involved hands-on. I reached out to good old Facebook and I put a post simply asking my friends if they knew of any kind of grassroots effort that I could be involved in towards supporting this cause of, you know, education of the underprivileged kids. And a friend of mine from my hotel days in India, he mentioned that his he mentioned this couple that was running a school. They have this school. It's about 200 miles north of New Delhi, up in the Himalayas and stuff, in a small little village over there. He knew of this couple because his grandmom was, I think she worked in the orphanage that these two kids grew up, and then they decided to get married, and eventually, because of their own experiences in life, as most of us get our motivation, they decided to open a school and help the education so that they could give the kids a future, you know, a bright future, so to say. That's how I found out about the cause. And the book, the school is called Mercy of God. I went out over there. I was there in May of this year. And I'm really glad that I'm supporting the school, because these two, this couple, they are phenomenal. They are solid. They're rock solid. They have a lot of integrity. The kids love them. They have stood the test of time in their effort towards supporting the education, because they had a lot of challenges from community, from parents. You can imagine what happens, at least in India, is rural India, where there's a lot of illiteracy and poverty. The highest priority of the parents is not really to send the kids to get educated, but to go and start working as soon as they can. So they have overcome a lot of these obstacles, and they're doing a pretty damn good job of helping these kids out. And they've got 59 children right now. Yeah, so that's how this kind of vision has grown to supporting a school. And now what I would really like to do is make creative philanthropy into almost like a larger, wider scale movement by inviting artists to contribute towards social impact using their art. So, you know, it's still in kind of prototype phase as to what the model would look like, but that's where this whole effort is moving into, as well as at some point maybe answering the question that if we were to educate our children all over again, how would we do that? So, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about your upbringing and like your education and how that affected the way that you're perceiving education and wanting to help people?
Sure. So my dad was from the Indian Navy, and as a result, the quality of the education which I had was fairly good. We moved around a bit within India mainly, and I went to some decent schools. So, but anyway, being in that environment, you kind of are familiar with the schools which are not that great, and the kind of education or a lack of education for a number of children. So I always had that general awareness that what's going on in India in terms of poverty and illiteracy, that's a big challenge for the country. So I did not think about it too much at the time, but I think the trigger, like I mentioned, was more this whole effort of the birthday gift for Ida. And it kind of grew from there. I knew that what I want to do in terms of impact was work with kids, okay? Maybe about from a few years ago when I was thinking about what am I going to do? What do I enjoy the most? But it wasn't like something which I said, okay, when I was 20 years old, then I'm going to do this. So it kind of evolved, and then came the trigger of writing this book. It's easy for me to work with those kids and stuff because I know the context very well. The language helps. And generally what I see is that these children, they have a great hunger and they have fire, you know, they have real fire in their belly. They're hungry. All they want is to be given the opportunity. So I'm glad that I can make a small difference over there in helping these kids in some way. It's still at the very front end of it, Kevin. This book has recently been released, and the royalties will start coming in from quarter one of this year. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. What did you study in school? Were you into the creative side of things, or were you mostly on the like technical or scientific or mathematical side?
Okay, after all, no creativity. Sports was big for me all the time. A lot of sports, whether it was athletics, basketball, cricket, and later on it became golf. So schooling was in India. Then I studied hotel school. I worked in a hotel for about 5-6 years, hotel operations I managed. And then I transited into the corporate world. I worked with General Electric for a while, worked with their aircraft engines and the analytics business in India for a couple of years. After that, I came across to the UK to do an MBA. So, yeah, I mean, just carry on doing the work, which I love doing, which is working with people, organization development, managing change, all the personal development work. I did that for a number of years before then I transitioned into management consulting in the US. So no creative, nothing. I would not say that I consider myself to be gifted in any creative endeavor, because for me, the definition until recently, creativity is associated with artists. Artists are gifted people, and that's not me, you know? So none really, Kevin.
Was that something that stopped you from thinking about this on a larger scale in the beginning?
In the beginning, what sort of time frame? Are you talking about just back in time?
Like when you were writing the book,
right,
in the initial stages,
mm-hmm.
you said you wanted to just make it a short fly and give it as a gift.
Yeah.
You didn't have any concept of this as a larger project.
No, it has grown organically from, but what I think I had was desire, strong desire. And starting off on it, which is where what happens otherwise is we get caught up too much mentally and we don't take the first few steps. And I think that's what basically I did. I know I'm not a great gifted writer. I'm not taking any courses on creative writing, nothing. It was just the desire and the passion behind it. I did that, and I used the people who have got those gifts. You know, so when I did the illustrations for the book and I did the writing, and I actually then said, okay, I'll send it to a publisher and see what they think about it. And they said, you know what, if you want this to be sold at a larger scale, we recommend that you use a professional illustrator. As much as I do not like to hear that, I said, okay, this is not about me really. You know, this is turning into something which is much larger than me. And I just took on the feedback, and I worked with an illustrator in India, a very gifted gal. Her name is Tina Rajan, one of the top few Indian women illustrators. And I used Tina because the book is set in India, and then, you know, it's kind of the kid or the main protagonist she then travels to Australia for a holiday and stuff like that. I guess we'll come into that a little later on, but it was important to have somebody who knows the Indian context to bring out those colors and the expressions. So what I'm saying is that desire, taking the action, using the people who could help me put it together. It's a very long drawn process, much longer than I would have liked it to be. And that involves my own procrastination in between too. So that's how I did it. And I can break it up into further steps if you would like me to. If anybody else has a question, they can just get in touch with me and I can help them through the process.
Mm-hmm. When you were initially doing it, was it like on pen and paper and you're making little drawings, or how did that work?
Oh, so the writing I was doing on my laptop when I was flying. The drawings I did when I was doing the illustration at the school at the Art Institute of Chicago. Because I had a clear objective in mind. I had the story, or I was developing the story, and I had about 11 beats to it. So I developed my illustrations while I was doing the course at SAIC. That's how I did it.
What kind of style were you using for these drawings?
Oh, my God. It's an embarrassment. You know what? Here's the deal. I'll tell you what happened once. Okay, so I was very proud of what I made. So it was a beautiful, nicely bound Shutterfly version. I put hearts in it. I put some beautiful pictures of Eli, and I thought it was really beautiful and stuff. I still think it is the Shutterfly version. It has a lot of love in it, so it is very precious and beautiful to me and my daughter. But so, you know, people, then you're excited to show it. People see, I got this book, this is for Ela's birthday, have a look at it, what do you think? They say, wow, are these drawings done by Ela? In some cases, yes, she is very gifted at age 3 or 4 to make these drawings. In some cases, I just let it be. And in some cases, I say, well, this is me. So, if that answers your question in some ways, it was nothing fantastic.
Did you go to the Art Institute just so you could create the illustrations for the book?
I went there because I really wanted to learn. Because here's the deal, okay? Now, my actual goal, I still am doing drawings. I have a sketchbook, and I do drawings, and I copy things, and I draw them. So I'm kind of developing my own. Everybody will have their own style of drawing, so I'm not really embarrassed about it. What I'm trying to get towards is, by the time I get to my third or the fourth book, I would like to write and illustrate my own books because, you know, I feel it. I feel what I'm writing. And these books which I write, they are based on true stories, true incidents. So this book, Deepa Wishes Daddy Happy Birthday, was based at that period of time when Ela went to Australia with Kate. I went to San Francisco. She was going to miss my birthday. And she's not going to be there with me on the 14th of November. And she made a beautiful, I mean, Kate helped her, but she made a beautiful 3-minute video wishing me birthday, which is, I mean, invaluable. So this book follows that. It's also educational in the sense that it's got this cultural contrast between India and Australia. But the underlying tension is that this girl is there. She's overseas and she's going to miss her dad's birthday. And this great big Indian festival called Diwali, which is like the Christmas anywhere else. And what do I do for daddy? So she has that running in the back of her mind and she comes up with this great idea. In fact, what I have done as well is for the people who buy the book, on the frame in which Deepa is cutting the cake for her dad to make this video, because that's there in the book as well, I have actually put a QR code to about 1 minute of the actual video which was made for me. So it gives people more an insight into my life and things. So what I'm saying is that the writing I'll be doing, I've written already in the plot of the book. It's set in Swaziland. It's based on this camping trip that we went for. And, you know, and it was also inspired by, I don't know if you ever had a chance to go to Swaziland. First of all, it's a great place. It's near Mozambique, and we went for this festival called Bushfire Festival. It happens in May. It's run by a guy called Jigs Thon. Phenomenal stuff they do. They have a lot of social impact-oriented events which happens around the festival. But this book is set about the whole experience of going for another holiday for the festival and her engagement with animals and wanting to participate in the festival. And there's obviously... attention beneath it as well. I'm not going to give that away right now. But what I'm saying is that my books, I think what I'll be writing, they'll be all based on true incidents which have taken place in my life. So they'll be all projects of passion for me.
To develop these stories, did you just pull from those incidents, or is there like an overarching narrative? Like, because you didn't go to school for writing or any of that. So how did you develop the story so that it's like a complete idea?
How do I do that? The first book, like I mentioned, was just simply that, okay, I want to do something for Ela, and I just started working on what I was already doing for her in terms of storytelling. When I was telling her a story, I would make up this Deepa character. And Deepa, she has a toy called Deepa. So Deepa is very embedded into her life. She's almost like a family member. Swaziland, this one, I think I just let it brew and I try to feel what I would like to write about. And I think what's happening is that it's connecting. Like, I really like what Jiggs is doing in Swaziland with his bushfire and all the work he's doing, and I want to support what they're doing. And then I thought, okay, how can, is there a nice story? Did I enjoy it? Yes, I enjoyed it. So I just try to put it into a plot. And now the idea with the second book is going to be that I'll try to identify a school in Swaziland, and I'll try to see actually if I can get an illustrator from Swaziland and an editor from there to put the book together. So I think it's like that. I've got a couple of more kind of plots written up, which again are very inspired by incidents between me and my daughter. And I just simply write plots and just go with the flow. Yeah? If it feels good and feels like an interesting thing to me, then I pursue it. So nothing scientific about it, Kevin, at all, as you can see.
Are there any moments in the first book that really stood out to you that you really wanted to tell before all the others? Or were they pretty much all equal, on equal footing?
No, I think the first book, for me, the most important thing was that birthday video, yeah, which is so touching. I think the people who see it will, if they have children, then, you know, it will resonate, especially if you're far away from your little child who's just 3 or 4. I think that was one frame which had a lot of emotional pull. And the other frame, that kind of goes into the killing the suspense of the last page of the book, so I won't go there. Let me think what else. And see, yeah, I think that's one frame, but here's the other deal as well. In this book, like the places that you will see in Australia, so Kate's from Australia, in Adelaide. So I have just used that, like it's their farmhouse. So the stories are actually set in real places where things have happened, where the birthday video was actually made. So I feel that was one, and I feel the other one was, yeah, when she was wishing Daddy goodbye at the airport. These two, I would say.
Can you recall the moment that you watched the video? Like, where were you? What were you feeling before and after? And, like, what kind of emotions occurred?
Yes, absolutely. It was the 14th of November, 2013. I had just moved across to the U.S. I was in East Bay at the time, living in Walnut Creek. I had some people over, about 20 people over. And these people who I met for the first time, we kind of connected, and they all showed up for the birthday, which was pretty amazing.
Wow.
But, Kate sent me the message that I sent you this video. Eli's made a birthday video for you. And I got the laptop out, and we were down over here in the open plan kitchen, and I put the video on, and I saw it for the first time, and it was very emotional. I mean, I had tears running down my cheeks, it's a very clear and vivid memory. It was very beautiful. I see it. I mean, I try not to see it too often, especially when Ela's not there, because it touches me a little too much.
Awesome. What do you plan to do with I know you have a philanthropy set up, so what are some of the things? I know you mentioned you want to take it to different areas, but how do you plan to get other people involved in it?
Yes, it's interesting. It's evolving, Kevin. So it's at the point right now. Let me just think about this. I think there are two or three clear areas that I would like to get into. One is me as an individual being the creative philanthropist and setting an example, leading by example. In that, I will write books, I will engage with the schools, and I will continue to do what I'm doing. So there's one part me, author stroke creative philanthropist, creating a template which could be then used. The other part of it is going to be, once I have that in place, I'm intending to bring it more into conscience by doing a TEDx talk this September. So once I get the ball rolling on that, the next stage is going to be to start inviting artists who align with this cause of supporting underprivileged kids and providing them a platform. And this could be a pre-existing platform, which could be a storefront for them to either sell, buy, or contribute towards this cause, to take it wider than just one person doing it. There are many big artists who do it already, but I'd like to make it as easy for grassroots level artists who would like to do something, but this is not their focus. It makes it easy for them to give back. And then the third thing is the educational system itself. Like I said, at some point, I feel I will come around to answering the question that if we were to educate our children all over again, and how would we do that? For right now, the baby steps into this is going to be experimenting with the one or two schools that I'm going to be working with, more around holistic education. So I do not, at this point in time, see myself or the people who will work with me disturbing the academic curriculum as much as building things around it. What would be examples? I feel that bringing mindfulness into these environments, connecting with nature, what else? Introduction of communication for parents and teachers, like nonviolent communication. What else? Having rites of passage ceremonies, so that it's not that when you turn 16, your first drink becomes your rite of passage, or you go and, you know, do something crazy. But you actually go through these time-tested traditions, which is very grounding, and which is very, what do you say, it's the recognition of that young adult coming into his or her own self. So it's evolving. It's evolving right now. It's just me and a, you know, part-time somebody that's helping. But if any of your listeners, if they resonate with it, if they have something they would like to do with us, they're very welcome to get in touch to do any kind of, you know, I have some specific areas of voluntary help, which would be great. That will be really useful. So these are the three areas that I see this growing into right now. I'm also curious to explore, what if you did not write stories and books for kids? That's one question which I have in mind. And there's another theme which I would like to develop in writing. So one is about these books being written based on incidents between what's been happening between me and my daughter. The other area is what I'd like to explore are more of these softer emotions, which are challenging, like love, gratitude, etc., for which we do not have enough language. I think if we had more language around it, we would not have the kind of emotional tension and all that stuff in relationships. So I am kind of keen to explore writing in a way to teach children the value of gratitude, or answer the question, what is love, with the intention that it becomes almost like the last book that a parent is reading the child before they go to bed. But here's what it does. Not only does it help the kid build those values and that language into their, you know, as they're growing up, it is also somehow re-educating the adults that let's get back in touch with our hearts. Let's get back in touch with this beautiful thing of giving back, etc. So these are a few things which I have, you know, bubbling away in my mind.
Can you talk a little bit about each of those different points, like mindfulness? How did you discover that mindfulness was something that would be important to you?
I've been practicing it for a very long time. That's the first thing I recommend when I'm working with somebody in one-to-one personal coaching situations. If they do not have a regular stillness practice, it could be mindfulness. I mean, there are tons of ways you can have a stillness practice. Mindfulness, of course, has been, it's something which has been coined by John Kabat-Zinn, and he's brought it into mainstream. But essentially, it's a stillness practice where you tap into your inner wisdom. So I started practicing Buddhism when I was in my mid-20s. So somehow I just landed up, you know, with these group of people, and I enjoyed it for some time. And that's where the early beginnings of the inner working for me started off. And I have experienced various teachers along the way, and I've learned various different kinds of mindfulness practices and meditations and things. And I see the amount of difference it makes to me. I feel that it is something which is important, I think, anybody, because the world that we live in is just in so much of a frenzy all the time. And with technology, it is very easy to get disconnected. It's very easy to get just swayed away by whatever the most prevalent wind is, or whoever is the strongest person in that room. You just get swayed away. You can lose your agenda. So I think practices like these really help grounding you. And so it's out of personal practice, Kevin, completely, and of experiencing the great benefits of this practice, that I feel it's something which needs to be there.
And is connecting with nature part of that same practice, or is that something separate?
Well, it can be separate. It could be one big practice for you as well. Connecting with nature could simply be just simply going out with the intention of just being and not doing. So being in the being mode and just staying with yourself and seeing the beauty outside and whatever the message you get out there. So it's connecting to a force which is much larger than you for inspiration in many different ways. And there are many different modalities in which you can do that. So all the work, I mean, what I'm mentioning to you is really based on a lot of personal experience in this whole area of exploring a lot different modalities of developing the inner spirit, the inner world, the inner castle, as they say.
Is there a specific instance that you can recall in which connecting with nature or mindfulness has helped you through a situation that you thought was like very difficult to get through otherwise?
Yeah, I think, okay, there's very specific times, you know, when you go through these challenging periods in your life. And for me, this was the first one. It's happened again after that too, more recently, but I'll talk about what happened in 2008 for me, which really brought home the importance and the significance, and after which I really don't. I make it a point to do my meditation practice as well as exercise. And this is when I finished off some consulting work. I was in Edinburgh at the time, in Scotland. That got over in Feb 2008. And I was developing a golf business. So I really enjoyed golf. And I was anyway getting kids to Scotland once a year for junior golf camps to St. Andrews and stuff. And I was trying to make a big business out of it. I was business plan, 5-year cash flow statement, balance sheet, you know, to go down the investor route. So I was doing that, and I was trying to, so I said I'll give myself about 3 months before I start looking for work again and seeing how this goes. And I was putting in all my money at the time, so you got to pay your rent, I kind of had a small little place in the Edinburgh University incubator, so the rent was not too high for the office, but I wanted to separate the personal from the workspace. And then building the business meant a lot of driver licenses, insurances. It's highly regulated in the UK, at least. I don't know how it is in the US right now. I haven't tried it over there. But a lot of expenses, long story short, it did not really work out. The 2008, the whole, you know, what happened in 2008, the whole financial fiasco took place. Travel businesses are notorious in terms of their delinquency. So I really could not raise any money. Nothing worked out over there. I was not getting any work. And I had to keep my sanity in some bloody way, man. I would just do my meditation practice every single day, and I would go and exercise and run, you know. By the time I got to this, I mean, I gave up the gym membership, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, because of the financial constraints. It was pretty challenging, so I would just go and run or do any form of exercise and do my mindfulness practice every single day, which kept me going.
Are there any sort of discoveries or self-reflections that specifically help you get through that?
Any self-reflections that help me get through that phase? I think the one thing for me is that I find a way to give myself hope. And that's really important, I feel, in situations like this. That I kind of had a big idea at that time. Even with this, like you see, it's, you know, I mean, yeah, I really feel that it was being able to give myself hope. It was very challenging, please don't get me wrong. It was very, very challenging. There were days when I was completely frozen, that I could do nothing at all, okay? So it's not that I did this and I was in a high. No way, it just was not like that, but this really helped me cope. I feel that's one thing which really helps me, that I can give myself hope. And I feel that at some deep gut level, I do kind of bet on myself, you know? So, I don't know, does that answer your question anyway?
Yeah. What do you think the importance of believing in yourself is, as opposed to people who like get down on themselves when they see failure?
Well, I didn't get down on myself when I saw failure. I think it's very natural to do that. But I feel that beneath that, there was that always that inner voice that you can get up one more time. Just get up one more time. Only one more time. And somehow just need to tell yourself, just, you know, take one day at a time now, or 1 hour at a time now. Let's go back to your question. So what is the difference in being able to believe in yourself versus not? I think there are a few things to it. I feel that maybe some people are more wired that way, number one. I think the other thing which really helps in those times, or even when you're not really in those times, is that if you have been in an environment where people have believed in you or have really been cheerleaders for you, that's a huge differentiator. And I'll use an example. I feel when you look at guys like, I'm going to use a golf example over here, okay? Guys like Rory McIlroy, who are champion golfers, they're fearless, completely zero fear. They can act through it. They may be having fear, but they can act through it because they have tremendous self-belief. And I feel that's where great parenting, great teachers come in, but not everybody has that. I feel what happens is that when you start off on your journey, when you start off really kind of saying, you know, this is really important to me, and I'm going to set sail on this path, and if you kind of commit to it, I think somehow that the teachers show up, and that support network emerges at different points, which will push you forward. And I feel that this will happen if you want to take that risk and fly off the cliff. And I also feel that these opportunities come our way. And it's that classic thing about Joseph Campbell, you know, and his whole hero's journey thing, that when you have that call to adventure, you have a choice of taking it or not. And what usually happens is what stops that hero's adventure, the hero's journey, is our threshold guardians. And the threshold guardians are those people, they are caring about you. You know, inadvertently, they may not let you go off on that adventure because there is this tried and tested template, which, just do that. Just do that. Why do you want to rock the boat? So they do it out of goodwill, out of care and love. But somehow I feel that can come in the way of stopping you on your own hero's journey and discovering who you really are. And it could be corporate job for you, it could be artist for you, it could be who knows what, it could be more than one thing as well. I don't feel that you have to relegate yourself that, okay, like for me, I will not only write books, I'll still carry on doing my consulting work, my coaching work and stuff. So, but I just feel that if you step out of that path and you put yourself out there, and the more clear you get, and in, you know, if you're more, the clearer you get and the more you put yourself out there, serendipity is what shows you the way. And for that, I feel the other practice, which is really important, is to have some practice to keep that heart of yours open. Keep it open to see what is emerging. Be sensitive to what's emerging. That's a big challenge because we have a lot of templates. We have a lot of ideas. We have the mind which is analyzing all the time, and we're getting far ahead of ourselves. Okay, so in a way, that's me coaching myself right now, that you know, just keep it open right now. I have this urge that I want to give it this shape or this form and do this and do that. But then somehow coming back to yourself and saying it's growing organically, it's growing beautifully. See the kind of support that's come your way. Just take one step at a time and let things emerge, and then you will know where you need to put a lot of focus on. That's challenging, I feel. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
There is a great deal of good in believing in yourself, but there are times when you can't go any further. So how do you know the difference between whether you should continue on the path that you're going and then, you know, giving up because it's insurmountable at this point?
I think the clear example was the golf thing, and then my circumstances changed, etc. But let me just talk a bit about that, answer that in the context of what's happening for me maybe right now. Because I'm kind of in that place right now myself, to be honest. And it's not a place for me where I need to give up what I'm doing. It's more of a place for me to slowly go into the unknown. Sorry, just go back to your question one more time, Kevin.
Oh, like how do you know when you're supposed to continue on the path that you're going on?
Yeah.
Or the point where you're like, oh, okay, either I need to change or shift my focus or like give up because, you know, this thing is not going to work.
Mm. So one indicator I feel is that if you're trying too hard and it's not working out, which means that it does not mean that this is not what you got to do. It probably means that at this point in time, you need to just let it be or let it go or let it be. And that is only something which you can intuit. And that's why I feel that mindfulness is a great skill, because it puts you in touch with that gut. If you're a change maker, if you're a game changer in this world, if you're going to create your own path, you're walking down this journey, you may have great mentors and coaches, but you have to pull the trigger yourself. And that's where tapping into your gut is invaluable. And change makers and, you know, people like them, they are often on these crossroads. Now, what the hell do I do again? I'm a gay here. So I feel that if you're trying too hard on trying to, you know, really try to make something work, it's not working out, then there's a message for you over there. You could use coaches at that time to reflect. You could use some people around you to reflect. I feel it's great to get some perspective from different people that you value and trust. I think that's one sure thing. And then at times you just have to be and not take too much of action and focus on your own well-being and your own goodness and nourishing your own spirit, and then see what emerges from that space, you know? So I feel that's one thing which is an indicator that, okay, buddy, just let it go for now. That's what I would say.
That's good, because it brings us full circle back to the point where if you just listen internally to what's going on, it often reveals the truth that you need to listen to.
And see, that's where the whole self-belief and trusting and everything comes in. And I think it's a learned skill, for sure. Some people may be more adept to it, and many people not. Very few people, I feel, will have those perfect environment circumstances where teachers and parents and everybody are so aligned and so loving and so nurturing that you are just built with a strong internal channel which is solid. But for most of us, it will come in the form of, me included, it will come in the form of people along your journey. Different people, different, you know, parents will play a different role at different points in time, and your teachers, etc. So, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the mindfulness practice that you have and like how people can use certain aspects of that into what they want to do?
Right. So mindfulness, or you can call it a stillness practice, or you can call it meditation. There are tons of ways people can do this. Deepak Chopra will probably pre-run this 21-day meditation challenge free of cost. Just do it. There are a number of apps out there, meditation apps. You can start off with guided meditations. And you can go that way, because that just makes it easier. You can sit for even 5-10 minutes. And here's the one big thing which stops people from meditating. is that the goal of meditation is to get my head empty of thoughts. So I do actually do a bit of mindfulness workshops as well. So in the Bay Area, I've been doing some. So, and that's really not the goal of it. The goal of you is to be present with yourself in this moment in time. So please get away from the notion that you want to empty your mind of thoughts. Impossible. Well, let's not say that. It is possible in certain kinds of meditations, like the Vipassana meditation. And if you sit for about maybe a couple of hours, what I see is that you get into these spaces where no matter how hard you try, you just cannot think. Okay, but that is not practical for day-to-day life. Vipassana is this 10-day silent meditation. Day-to-day life, the goal is stillness, being with yourself, getting in touch with what your body is saying. And yeah, so look at some apps, use some guided meditations, or if you can just sit in one place, just show up and sit there, put a timer on for 10 minutes and be with whatever's coming up, thoughts coming up, let them pass by like clouds. I mean, we will all flounder, and you remember you're back into planning dinner for your friend, bring yourself back to the present moment. So, yeah, that's what I would say. There's a lot of resources out there for sure, Kevin.
Cool. You mentioned earlier one of those principles was the rite of passage. Can you talk about that and what your thoughts on that are?
Oh, my God. I haven't experienced one myself in the way I'm talking about it, but this was brought to my awareness when I was helping, I was working with somebody. This is a lady who I met in Botswana. So I spent some time in Africa the same time when I went to Swaziland for the bushfire festival. I spent some time in Botswana and I met Thea Khama over there. She is doing phenomenal work with the youth of Africa. I think her website is Inner Core Energetics. Well, not of Africa, sorry, in Botswana. She works with the teens. And I think her program is this 4-day program called Teen Spirit. And that's where she brought into my awareness, because I was just trying to learn from her what she's doing because of this curiosity of mine, how to look at the schooling system and do something different. And she mentioned an organization called Generations, and one of the things they completely focus on is doing rites of passage for young adults from adolescents and stuff like that. So personally, I haven't experienced it, but I really like the whole idea about it. I've seen it on YouTube, etc. And it makes sense that you don't go around vandalizing cars, etc., or being your first drink and all those things. But you have a different marker, a much more connected, a much more respectful marker, which shows that trust and the love for the child who's now becoming an adult, saying we recognize the adult in you. And that can be so reaffirming, you know, for many kids, that would be, I would guess.
What kinds of things happen in this passage?
It's mostly in nature. You're connected, you are there in nature, and different organizations will do different things, different practices. What could be some examples of what would be there? Let me think about it a little. Because I know that Generations does this in various different cities, and they do a different number of things. What else would they do over there? Can we come back to this?
Yeah.
Cool.
Can you talk about how you learn from working with large businesses and consulting and how you're trying to use that information and bring it into philanthropy?
Right. I think the greatest gift of having worked in corporate organizations and having tried to run a business of my own, etc., and doing management consulting is that I can work with an idea, I can work with a vision, I can break it down into the steps that are required to actually bring it to life. You know, so like proper classic project planning, etc. How do we go and what resources, planning it all out, putting it into a nice coherent framework, which not only will make sense to me, but then if I need to use that to raise capital from any philanthropist to fund, let's say, an operation now where we hired a few people, then that comes in really handy. So it's all that stuff. Yeah, it's all the being in that environment, working with. I did a lot of process work. Okay, so I've done a few different things that I've done really well in my work. A lot of organizing of events and things, which I did in hotels. And I worked with some very good. I worked with the Oberoi Hotels, which is top-notch hotel operations worldwide. People don't know much of that in North America because they're not there, but they are in Asia. Their hotels are the best in the world. Their resorts and stuff, Condé Nast, top. So great, great education, because I started off as a management trainee with them. Great eye for detail, customer service, creating events, running profit centers. Then I move into General Electric, and there it's all data-driven. They use Six Sigma to do every single thing. So everybody who works in GE, pretty much, if you need to progress, you have to do some form of Six Sigma training. So you start off with doing a green belt training, and you get up to a black belt, etc. So I did a green belt training over there. So I use that methodology usually to construct my projects. So define, measure, analyze, improve, and control. So that gave me a great data-oriented way to go about looking at business-related problems, using data, using voice of customer to build solutions, and and then putting it all into, mapping it out into a process. All right, so this is what we're saying. Here's the voice of customer. Here's the analysis. Here is all the F&D diagrams. And, you know, based on all of this stuff, this was the process beforehand. Based on this, which is what I did in my management consulting assignment recently as well. Here is what it looks like. Now, here's what we suggest. So that really helps me quite a lot in structuring my thoughts.
Hmm. And what is the difference between the two? Because there are definitely similarities and differences. What do you think the biggest difference is?
Between?
Business and philanthropy.
So, see, if you want to, I would imagine, see, there are different kinds of philanthropy, right? There could be somebody who is simply an individual who likes to give, you know, who's giving money away. And then there are foundations and their organizations. They're all organizations. I mean, they have cause to it. They're no different in terms of being run. They just have, like, let's look at what, yeah. The operations of an airline, they need to make sure they maximize profits and their effectiveness and their everything around how they utilize the seats. You know, so they use various processes and develop and also deliver shareholder value, because that's what drives them. They have different kind of stakeholders. But it's no less, I mean, you have various stakeholders when you're running a philanthropic organization or you're running a social enterprise, I would say. So mine is going to be more on the lines of a social enterprise, which means cause-oriented, but at some point, also down the line, be able to generate profits of the money for running your operation than relying completely on funding. And that's pretty much to be run like an operation, like a business. So I don't see that any different. You need to hire good people. So if you have any experience in HR and recruitment, etc., that comes in handy. If you know how to, you know, around developing your people, what are the opportunities? How can you use profiling tools? That comes in very handy. Operations, how do you structure an operation? How do you structure the organization? What's it going to look like? What's the focus going to be? What's the vision? All these things, they are things you do in a corporate setting. And they are great skills to use anywhere, I feel.
Huh. Cool. Another question I had was about coaching. How did you get into coaching? How did you get into coaching?
Okay. I did a lot of that as a part of my job. So, you know, as an operations manager in the hotels, I was responsible for hiring, and then I had a team, a large team. I managed teams from between 7 to about 40, 50 people at a time. And coaching is a very important part of managing a team. So I've done that in those settings. I think what really makes it easy for me, I just genuinely have this desire to be able to work with people and help them and do something great in their life, or whatever they would call great. Not everybody has to do something huge, big, and impressive. Whatever's great to them, whatever calls them, how do you help them do that? So operationally, and then I did organization development. You know, after the MBA, about 10, 12 years, I did organization development, which is all about building high-performing teams, which is about creating mentoring programs, coaching programs, managing performance. So all that work, and a very natural part of that was to work with managers and do individual one-to-one coaching, and also creating action learning sets, which is a peer-to-peer coaching model, I feel, which is phenomenally impressive and effective. So that's it. So now what I do is I call my coaching the game changer coaching, and I use all the experience that I've got. I've been lucky to work in Asia, in Europe, in Africa, in North America, and I've worked in different operations, different organizations, and I do a lot of my own inner work. And I feel this really helps me add value to those who feel that they resonate with who I am and what I'm trying to do. Essentially, when they look at the website and they read, you get a vibe. So it's been a natural extension of what I've been doing for a number of years. It's just that now I've put it into this kind of package service, which people can make use of.
Cool. What advice would you give to somebody who may not consider themselves creative? And what to do, like you have done, in order to like create something, even though they don't think they're creative themselves?
I think one thing which happens is that, like I mentioned earlier on, creativity is associated with artists. At least that's the way I perceive it. Creativity, artist means gifted, great guy. I'm not creative. Let me not try it out. The thing which I did was I had a desire, I had something which I wanted to do, an expression of something which only I could do. And I used storytelling. So I feel that it could be anything, you know, whatever you feel that you completely are drawn to. It could be in your own profession, maybe writing something if you're a lawyer or a consultant. It may be just writing a white paper based on these different concepts and experiences where you put something together which is your creation. I feel that most of us have those desires, and what stops us is that we don't take those first few steps on it. For one could be that this whole thing about, oh, I'm not a creative guy, I have the desire to write a book. There are millions of people who want to write books, but so few of them actually take action because they don't perceive themselves to be an author. So I feel one is that coming in their own way, but the way to get over that is simply start with the first few steps, or work with somebody. Work with somebody you resonate with, whether it's a coach, it's a friend. Just go and say, somebody you trust, you feel comfortable and safe with, and simply say, you know what, I have the desire, I want to make quilts. And will you hold me accountable? I'm going to try to do this, you know. So would you mind if I check in with you or speak to somebody you know who's done it? So I would say that one is either find a coach or a mentor, or find somebody who you trust, who you feel that would be this non-judging person who will support you in your journey, but take the first few steps. I think that's the key. And, you know, creativity comes in so many different forms. And this friend of mine, his name is Tom Shillaw. He's based in Scotland. I mean, he used to work in sports nutrition, okay, elite sports nutrition with boxes and stuff like that, but he always had this nagging thing about doing something with language, how to use language to help people in therapeutic settings. And what he has created is just pure magic. He uses language based on neurolinguistic programming and a lot of other various modalities, language and the interpretation of body language, in helping people through challenging emotional situations. I have trained with him because I was, you know, doing NLP workshops, and I just saw him, how he uses his creativity, his calling. In this sitting, conversationally, he helped out this 25-year-old girl get over a depression that she had since age 13, etc. So here's a great example, not what you would conventionally call creative, but this is something which I feel the way he does it is something which only he can do. And he's rapidly healing people with incurable conditions like color blindness and things like that. His range and his depth is just boundless because he's so drawn to it. You know, he's so in tune with archetypal energies. So he's doing some great work. He's, I think, in India. So he's a great guy as a great example, I feel. Tom Shillock, yeah, he's great.
Very cool. I have a couple more questions left.
Go ahead.
What is your favorite quote?
Oh, what's my favorite quote? One of my favorite quotes is, and I don't know who this is by, I don't remember. It is, where you stumble is where you find your treasure. And this is usually when we have a challenging, this is, for me, it resonates because it's usually where you have a very challenging situation. And then are you going to skim over that and not dive deep in over there into the shadow, into the darkness? Or you will choose to do that. And if you choose to do that, you will find something precious there, but it takes work.
Very cool. Do you have a morning routine? And if you do, what is it?
We already spoke about it. For me, it's meditation, anywhere between 30 minutes to 45 minutes. And that's only because I've been doing this for a number of years that I can do that. For people who are starting off, I feel 10 minutes is a great start. But there are a few other things which I think I'd like to mention, which I do, which really help me personally over a period of a week. One is, of course, the morning routine of meditation every single day. Then I do a bit of conscious movement, like a five rhythms dance or soul motion, putting my body in movement, putting my body in motion so I can break out of any inertia or any stress and strain that the body is holding on to. And then, of course, you know, three times in a week, I try to go for a workout. So that's how I try to, that's my routine over a period of a week.
Awesome. Who is somebody else that you know that's personally extremely creative, and then someone you don't know who is also extremely creative? So who is someone you personally know, other than Tom, and then somebody you don't know personally?
Okay, somebody who... Let me start with somebody who I don't know, okay? That's easily coming to my mind right now. I recently came across... It's actually a theater group. It's a dance group called The Attraction Shadow Dance. They have the most phenomenal shadow dancing storytelling way. It's just amazing. You can check them out on... How I got to this was, I have a certain story which I've been wanting to put into a script and also, you know, bring it out to the world. And I was thinking what modality, and I thought maybe I enjoy dancing, so I can probably try to see how I can use my... How to use dance to do some storytelling. And then I just did that, dance as a form of storytelling. And there comes this great Hungarian group called Shadow Dance, called Attraction. And they were on, the video clip was this YouTube clip on Britain's Got Talent. And it's just mesmerizing how they use the body to tell this amazing story. It's really worth checking them out. So there, that's one great example of recent creativity that I have encountered, which I really enjoyed completely. And what's an example of somebody who I know who is highly creative? Can this be? I know a few really gifted artists. Will you give me a few seconds? Can we go back and come back to this? Is there anything else you want to ask me?
Oh,
or are we at the end of it?
We're almost at the end, but I can ask you the last question.
Go ahead.
Oh, actually, no, there's one more. Are there any books, resources, podcasts, or anything along those lines that you would recommend for people?
Books, resources, and podcasts. Okay, let's start with...
Or documentaries or anything like that.
Right, so let's start with books. I'll mention a couple of books which I've reread a number of times, and a book that I'm currently reading. I have reread a book called The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success. It's by Deepak Chopra. It takes about 45 minutes to read a number of times. It's just magic. It's very simple. It's just pure simplicity. And as the name suggests, you know, it has got one spiritual law for each day, which is a great reminder for myself just to go within and be centered. That's one book. I usually listen to it on Audible. The other book, which I really read a few times, is The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. Once again, very simple wisdom. It's by a guy called Robin Sharma. These two are very interesting books, which I've read a few times. And the book that I'm reading right now, I'm reading a couple of them, but I just started reading a book called The Untethered Soul, which is again very fascinating to me. So these are some books. Podcasts. I have enjoyed a few podcast interviews by UYD Media. Use Your Difference to Make a Difference is the name of the program. It's run by this young millennial called Theo Roxon. I think he's based in New York. And he has interviewed some very fascinating people. So, you know, if you're looking for some inspiration from everyday people who are doing something, who are using their difference to make a difference, you might want to check this out. Some tools that I recommend is, I think we've spoken about it extensively, I feel that the most invaluable thing, the greatest gift, is developing some form of a mindfulness practice. Really, I think that's just invaluable. So, yep, these are a few things, Kevin.
Cool.
Okay.
And if you want to go back, you can. Or if not, I can ask you the last question that I have.
Please go with the last question. I'm so
what is your definition of creativity, and what can people do to be more creative?
Okay. And I think, once again, we've covered bits and pieces of this. For me, creativity is just your unique expression of your own spirit, of your heart. And I feel the important thing is that this is not meant to be competitive. It's not meant to make you look good. It's just your own pure expression. That's really what it is. And what would be one thing we spoke about recently, which is simply that if you have an urge or a desire, take action on it, or find some people or find some support which you can have to help you try expressing what it is that you would like to try, whether it's writing or it's making some art on walls or it is anything. It is pottery. It could be anything. But I feel that the most important thing is scheduling, number one, putting it in your diary, and then following through with it. And use some people around you to hold you accountable for it if you can. If not, give me a call. I'll hold you accountable.
Very good advice.
So I'm still thinking, gosh, this is crazy, man. There you go. Yes, I can. I have somebody in mind. Okay. So I feel this other person who I find to be a very creative soul is a teacher. This is Berkeley. There's a lady called Valerie. She's the one who holds space, or who is the facilitator of Soul, S-O-U-L, Soul Motion Dance. She is a phenomenally gifted teacher. And dancing on that floor is just beautiful. So I feel, you know, and the words that she uses, the quotes that she uses, that she comes up with, and a lot of it is her own expression, is very soothing. It's like a blanket around your heart.
Awesome. Are there any parting words that you would like to give to the audience?
Parting words? I think they've already had enough of me. It's probably an hour and a quarter. But what I would love to do is just to thank you so much for having me on the show, and to thank your listeners. And in the old theme of helping the people starting taking their first few steps on, it could be anything which is holding them back. It's now we are in the new year, 2016. I will be very happy to offer two free 30 minutes one-to-one coaching sessions to the first person who gets in touch with me. Do you want me to share an email address or anything like that?
Yeah, if you have
an
email address or a website that you want to show people, that's great.
Yeah, okay. Well, the email, you could find me on Facebook. You could do that as well, Puneet Sachdev, which is P-U-N. I guess it'll be in your show notes, right, Kevin, my name, the spelling, etc.
Yep.
So you can just find me on Facebook. It'll say based in San Francisco. You can get in touch with me that way. Or you can write me an email on creativephilanthropist@gmail.com and just simply mention that you would like to have the coaching sessions. And I will happily do that. Is it okay for me to mention the social enterprise, the website?
Yeah.
Because that's a place if people resonate with this whole cause, they can go and actually, if they want to buy the book, they can do that. If they would like to volunteer sometime, that would be a great big help. So it's slightly lengthy, and maybe you can have it in the show notes again as well. It is www.thecreativephilanthropist.strikingly.com. And my one-to-one coaching website is www.gamechangercoaching.strikingly.com. I find it easy to make websites on Strikingly. That's why I use them. So, I mean, these are some ways. If you can't find me any of these ways, if you can get back in touch with Kevin, and, you know, he's got all of my coordinates, I'm happy for him to share that with you.
Awesome. Well, Puneet, this has been really fun talking to you. I think people will really enjoy some of your insights.
Okay, great, Kevin. Thanks for your time.
All right, thanks for coming on.
Cheers, Kevin.
All right, bye.
Bye.
And that's it for the 55th episode of Cracking Creativity. For show notes, go to crackingcreativity.org/55. If you like this episode, subscribe to the show on iTunes at crackingcreativity.org/subscribe. Also, feel free to write a review or leave me a comment about the show. Hope this stoked your creative fires, and I'll see you next time on Cracking Creativity.